from the crypt.
Hello, boys and ghouls. Welcome to a very special interview episode of Dads from the Crypt. My name is Jason. I'll be your host today. And today we're talking to a returning guest, director, writer, and composer, John Harrison. Welcome back.
Thank you, man. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you.
Glad to be back in the crypt.
You're another dad in the crypt. Dad from the crypt.
Yeah, that's it. Yep.
So you were with us back in March of 2022, yes. And we had a great chat about your work with George Romero, Tales from the Dark Side, your Tales from the Crypt episode, your work on Creepshow the movie and the TV. So we're gonna skip over all that, so we encourage people to go listen to that episode. But let's talk about what's going on now, what's going on forward. So what have you been working on?
One of the new things that I've been doing, and this is what happens when there's a pandemic and a guy has too much time on his hands. I've just finished a new book, which I finished it a little while ago, but it's just coming out this August 15th from Wordfire Press, Passing Through Veils.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a supernatural thriller that I'm really happy with. It was a lot of fun to write. The short blurb line is that a young woman moves into an old rundown townhouse in Georgetown, D.C., expecting to fix it up and, in a way, use it as a metaphor for her own character to be fixed up after this massive nervous breakdown she's had. She's an attorney. And as she's restoring this townhouse, she discovers a false wall in her bedroom. And behind it is an old vanity and some secrets hidden there. And the ghost of the woman who was murdered in this very house comes back and seeks revenge.
Nice.
And it's a little bit of psychological horror insofar as, is this really happening or is it only happening in her mind? And so it's the kind of stuff that I love. And it turned out really well, and Wordfire is a great partner in the publishing of it, and it'll be out August 15th. So you can pre-order it now from wordfirepress.com, or you can get it after the 15th at Wordfire or Amazon or Barnes & Noble or the variety of places. You can get it hardcover, paperback, Kindle, whatever you want. So it's exciting.
Yeah. Okay. So there's a lot to unpack there. So Georgetown, have you spent much time there?
Well, when I was a musician, we did. Yeah. Because the guitarist that I worked with, Roy Buchanan, was from the D.C., Virginia area. So, I kind of knew it. My son now lives there. Mm. He works in D.C. So I spent some time down there. But when you read the book, you kind of see why... it's a great location for this kind of story, because the woman who was murdered was married to a very rich and powerful individual. The intersection of politics and money and the supernatural all just kind of neatly fit together in this. And of course, there's a lot of that in the background of the book with the woman who is our lead character, because she works at a very high-powered law firm and gets involved in a lot of interesting situations that intersect this case. So I just felt as if it was kind of a sexy, exotic location to set this story.
Right. Well, that just makes me think of one of my personal favorite movies. The Exorcist is also another.
Right. And have you ever been to DC? Have you ever gone to the stairs?
So I was when my family moved to Silver Springs. When I was like one, and we moved when I was like nine. So like I've never been back. So it's one of those things I really need to go back someday and just kind of revisit everything, because everything, I don't remember everything very specifically. So I don't remember. I remember the monuments and stuff. I don't know if I ever went to Georgetown. I mean, I'm sure my family must have passed through there, but I don't have any concrete memories. But now I'm just picturing like an anthology called like the Georgetown Hauntings or like,
yeah, I'm sure there are a couple of others. I mean, The Omen had some scenes mm-hmm. set in Washington. There are definitely others. And of course, if you go to Georgetown, you can make a pilgrimage to the stairs where
right.
he comes down at the end. And it's a very famous place and everybody goes there.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the new the trailer for the Exorcist sequel, I guess it's called?
No, I haven't. That's not the one that's called The Pope's Exorcist, is it?
No, that's just another
story, yeah.
Different thing. That's actually very entertaining in like the bad way.
Yes, I watched it.
Oh, you watched it? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I was on. I was over in London last week, and I was watching it on the plane back home. And that's a perfect way to put it. It's entertaining in a bad way.
Right. There's a David Gordon Green who did the Halloween movies.
Oh yeah,
is doing a direct sequel to the original Exorcist, and they just released a trailer in front of Oppenheimer, of all things.
I haven't seen it, but I haven't seen Oppenheimer either. I haven't had a chance to get into the theater, so there I'm anxious go. To see that. But yeah, so. That's one thing that I've been doing. Of course, now we've got the strikes, and that's another issue.
Before we move off of that, though, I want to hear more about WordFire. Because I was looking into it a little bit, and I heard you talk about it with Al and Gil.
Yeah.
And I looked at their website, and it says, a publishing company that seeks to publish quality works of fiction and nonfiction while pioneering new models of cooperation and profitability among authors, readers, booksellers, and the publisher. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. I mean, I can't go into the details too much about the actual monetary differences because that hasn't really happened yet. Although I will tell you that the royalty rates are better than if you went to a major publisher. But on the other hand, they don't offer big advances. But what they will do is they will do the entire production of the book. I mean, this is not self-publishing. This is a legitimate, and they've got a number of titles and a number, if you look at their website, a number of really cool authors. But the great thing about it for me was it is run and founded by a fellow by the name of Kevin Anderson. And Kevin Anderson and I know each other from our days on Dune. Kevin is a New York Times bestselling author, multiple books, and has done a lot of the sequel and prequel books in the Dune universe with Brian Herbert, Frank Herbert's son. And Kevin and I met each other back when I was writing and directing the Dune miniseries and became friends. And, he's a terrific writer and a really great guy. And he founded this company some years ago, and it's been a home for some really cool publications. And when I finished Veils, I sent it to him to get him to give me a blurb. And then one thing led to the next, and he wanted to publish it. So, and they've been great partners.
That's great. Yeah, it's interesting how those dynamics are shifting.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, the publishing world, like all of the entertainment world, is new models are coming online all the time. And the big guys obviously still have the marketing muscle and the shelf space in the big bookstores and so forth. But it's really hard to cut through the noise when you're at that level. And I don't know how well you get treated. I can't say anything but great stuff about working with WordFire.
Yeah. Speaking about blurbs, your assistant sent me a couple, and of course I have to read the one from Clive Barker because it's Clive Barker. He said, Harrison's fiction lingers long after you turn the final page. He's a born storyteller.
Well, Clive is a born good friend.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, I've worked with Clive on several projects. Years ago, I was introduced to him through my manager at the time because Disney, this is an interesting story, Disney had bought his Aberrat novels. And I don't know whether you know anything about those novels, but they are very different for Clive, and they're based on his paintings. He is a wonderful artist, a very creative, excuse me, an exotic artist. And he created this whole world where a world exists of islands. It's an archipelago of islands, and each island is 1 hour of the day. So there's an island, and they all have different names, but each island is 1 o'clock all the time, midnight all the time, so forth. And so the islands of night are trying to take over the islands of day, and a young girl gets from our world gets swept up into that world, and she has she's heir to a prophecy and helps solve it. It's really wonderful. And you'd say, oh, Clive Barker and Disney, how does that work? They wanted to do it, and I wrote a live action adaptation for them of the novels, which didn't get made. There was another management change and, the usual blah, blah, blah. And they then tried to think about it as an animated feature, but because it's really a wonderful world that Clive has created, full of monsters and weird exotic creatures. And as I say, each one of these islands is a different hour of the day. Anyway, that began my relationship with Clive. And then not long after that, another producer that I'd worked with came to me and asked me if I wanted to take a shot at one of the Books of Blood, which were Clive's original short bursts onto the scene with the collection of short stories. And they were going to try and do a series of them. And of course, I jumped at the chance, and I wrote the first one in the series, which I directed in the UK, called Clive Barker's Book of Blood. And unfortunately, it didn't get the kind of release that I wanted. It was right around the time of the financial crash in 2008, and people just wanted to get their money out and, the usual story. So, but it turned out to be a terrific movie, and Clive and I have remained, buddies ever since. So I said, hey, man, would you have a look at my stuff and tell me what you think? Fortunately, he thought it was okay.
Yeah, the book you're describing reminds me a lot of probably one of my personal favorite Clive Barker's is The Thief of Always.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Where every day is an entire year. So you get to wake up to Christmas, and evening is like Thanksgiving, and every night is like New Year's, or, you get the whole cycle of a year one day, but the kids don't realize that they're aging one day at a time, like a year within a day.
His imagination is just unbelievable. And I really still believe that Aberrat could be a great series. It wouldn't be inexpensive, but maybe one of these days they'll come back to it.
Yeah. They talked about doing Thief of Always off and on for a while. Never. This just hasn't happened again. Conceptually, I can see the there's a lot of challenge, but I think someone could definitely do it. I think it'd be really special. I think it'd be a cool entryway horror, which I think, oddly, Clive Barker, I think, yeah, I could see. I when you say on paper, like on first thought, Clive Barker and Disney don't quite match, but then when you think about some of his other work, like the ones you're describing in The Thief of Always and stuff, I could really see a kind of back to throwback to like the kind of late 70s, 80s, where like Dark Crystal and things, where
Mike Aldrin,
where it was like a little more spooky, a little bit more adult, and some of that stuff backfired, but some of it was actually really good.
Definitely. And his stuff is infused all throughout with this kind of magic realism that really, as a filmmaker, I can look at and say, boy, I'd really like to sink my teeth into building that world. And in Aberrat, it was a great story because it could appeal to both adults and children.
Yeah.
It was like a fairy tale. It was a beautiful fairy tale.
Okay. So what else are you working on?
So the other thing that I'm really excited about, and this also started right around the time of the pandemic, is I was approached to write podcasts. And but not the kind of podcasts that you're doing, but fiction.
Fiction, yeah.
And the first one was one that's called Fear Worm. And it was a collaboration between a company called Treefort Media and the Universal Music Group. And the Universal Music Group and Treefort had this idea that they wanted to create an anthology series of really scary tales that would star the talent from the Universal Music Group, the rappers, the singers, the talent that they were pushing forward, especially their emerging talent. So I was called by a mutual friend, and I thought, well, this could be kind of cool, because I remember when my kids were younger, and even to this day, my son in particular loves radio drama. And I would buy him for his birthday and for Christmas the old Shadow radio plays. And so that's what these were. And they were fully produced radio drama with cast characters, effects, music. They were really cool. And I wrote six of them and directed six of them, or maybe eight. I can't remember. And they haven't come out yet, because the company is trying to find the right home. But it gave me the impetus to say, well, I really love this stuff, and why don't I do some more of it? So I have created a new series called John Harrison's Sinister Stories.
Wow.
And the difference between this and Fear Worm is that as Fear Worm is a full radio play of multiple characters and so forth, mine will be scary tales that I will curate from writers that I've worked with, writers that you know. You know, if I can, I'll get Clive to give me one. Mm-hmm. I'll try and get Steve King to give me one. I'll not give me necessarily, but yeah. Josh Mallerman, John Esposito, people that are known in the biz that I've worked with. And I will take those stories, and then I will go to actors that I've worked with over the course of my career and say, I want you to narrate these. Come into the studio for a day and just have a lot of fun with these things. But the difference between that and just doing an audiobook kind of reading will be that I will then score them and put sound effects to them. So I created I took one of my own short stories and I created a prototype called I See You. And we currently have, I'm not at liberty to talk about too much here in business detail, but you would recognize the name. We're currently about to close a deal with a major horror media outfit that wants to put these out. So I'm really excited about these.
Yeah, I think and sometime last year I think Jordan Peele put out his company put out like a podcast radio drama. Mm-hmm. That was very successful.
There have been several, yeah. And people love them. I mean, mm-hmm. because you can listen to them anytime. These would be half hours. You know, I wouldn't say they're bite-sized, but they are easily, you don't have to commit. It would be an anthology.
I mean, that's like a drive to work, you know, or drive to
work. Yeah, exactly, so exactly. Or before you go to bed, if you're mm-hmm. not afraid. Because hopefully these will be pretty scary.
Right. And, or like I walk my kids to school, so I often listen to a little bit of a podcast on the way back, and I'll walk the dog, listen a little bit more, do dishes.
And we're going to give them great soundtracks. I have my own studio here, and so I was able to do the prototype as a way to really sell people on how good these could be. And so I'm real excited about these. And then there are a couple of other projects in the nascent stage of development that hopefully I'll be back out on the floor sometime within the next 6 months, depending on how the strikes go.
Do you have any work that was put on hold. They can talk. I guess you probably can't talk about it because it's been struck. But
yeah, it's a little hard to talk about. Yeah. yes, but there is one in particular that we're just waiting for the logjam to break, and then we'll be gone. But there is the new season of Creepshow TV series on Shudder, which I'm told we actually finished it last year.
Okay.
But they've been waiting to decide when to put it out. And of course, the best time for them to put it out is October, the fall, Halloween. Right. So the new season, which would be season 4, I'm told will be out this Halloween. Excellent. And I've got a couple of episodes in there that I'm really happy with.
That's really cool. I'm really excited for that because that, yeah, I really love that show.
It's been fun. It's been a lot of fun to do it. And I have to credit Greg Nicotero for really, because, you know, I was involved in the first one with George.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime people talk about, well, let's remake this or let's do this, I'm always skeptical to know that they will honor the intentions or the ideas of the original, because they were great to begin with. So why fix what's not broken?
Yeah, we actually recently did a full review on Creepshow. It was like almost 2 hours of just gushing over it.
He's done a great job with the talent he's put together and the stories that he's curated. And he's very attentive to the original intentions and the look and the style of it. So I got to give him full props for that.
That's excellent. Yeah, really looking forward to that. All right. And first of all, I'm really excited to hear about your podcast project. I think knowing that you're going to score alone, like you can just give me the scores on their own. I'm sure people would be into that. But now if we're getting stories on top of it and voice acting and effects. That just sounds, I'm very, very excited for that.
Well, depending on the schedule, I'll score as many of them as I can because I love to do it. Mm-hmm. But if I can't, then I'm going to pull in guys that you probably would be familiar with and would love their music too, you know, because I've worked with them and it'll be great to pull them on and we'll all have fun.
Yeah. So let's talk about scoring and composing. So when you approach that, how do you approach that? So you're given the movie and say, we'd like a score. So do you, I'm not a musical person whatsoever, so tell me your process.
Well, I think my process is probably a little bit different because I never made a career of doing movie scores exclusively. My involvement in doing that came out of my relationship with George. I was his assistant director, and I think I've told this story many times. Maybe I even told it on the earlier podcast here. That when we were doing Creepshow, he was initially going to use library music, what we call needle drops, because he'd done a lot of his movies that way. He wasn't a musician, but he had an incredible musical sense. And he was an editor, a terrific editor. So he could take 2 or 3 music cues and make something entirely new, make a new cue out of them. But while we were doing the movie, he kept talking about, boy, it would really be nice to have some original music for this because it's going to have its own style. And while it is a comic book homage to the 50s, maybe it would be fun instead of having the score of the music cues from the 50s, which we were really originally going to use, a score that would reflect that style but be original. And I said, well, listen, George, I've got some gear. Let me put a cue together. We see if you like it for the theme, and we'll go from there. And of course, he did. And one thing led to the next, and I did the whole movie. And then Day of the Dead came along. But the difference was that I was able to be part of it during the entire production, which is very unusual. So my process is a little bit different because, unlike the normal process, which is a composer will be brought on and then given a cut of the film. He may know the composer. I mean, we know all the great stories about the Spielberg-Williams relationships and things like that, where they can talk about it in advance. But most of the time what happens is the composer is brought on, sees a cut, goes away, writes, does a spotting session with the director and the editors, post-production people, this is where we want music, and then they write it. In my case, I was able to be part of the process of making the movie in the first place. So I had an ear of the director the whole time we were doing it. And when we did Day of the Dead in particular, I had my gear set up in the post-production facility so that while they were cutting, I was constantly writing, sending stuff upstairs, laying it up, looking at it, making revisions. This works, that doesn't work, change this, do that. So I had the whole movie temp scored before we finished the movie and then recorded the score. So it's my process is a little different. But I also have thought, and I think all the great composers do feel this way, that music is as much a story element as the cinematography, the dialogue, the acting. And so what you really want to do is get inside the mind of the storyteller, in this case, the director, the filmmaker, and make your music part of that narrative. So, as I say, I've never made a career of just being a composer for other people's movies. Most of the stuff I've written has been either for George or for myself. Tales from the Dark Side, or the Tales from the Dark Side TV shows that I did, that I did all the music for, my episodes. The podcast that I'm telling you about, where I'll do the music for it. The process is very much one of looking at the story and trying to be a narrative element for that particular piece, if that makes any sense.
No, I mean, that makes lots of sense. Are you thinking about like the vibe, or like a character, like the music as a character, or like the music, how the music interacts with the characters? So I think of like the Dark Knight and the Joker theme, or the Batman.
All of the above. All of the above. I just finished an absolutely brilliant biography of Max Steiner. Mm-hmm. And of course, he's not just a horror composer, but he was one of the greats in the golden era. I mean, his credit lists are just phenomenal. But it's such a great biography because he talks about everything that you just mentioned, how he would get into the mind of the character and try to find theme and motif that would work identifiably with that character, even though you might change it. You might modulate it from major to minor. You might put it in a different key in different scenes. You might accelerate the tempo or not. I mean, but he would think about music as a narrative element, and all the great ones did, you know, Bernard Herrmann, for example. I mean, what he did for, all of Hitchcock's films, yeah, and Psycho, how he created suspense and all the others. So it really is a matter of mood and atmosphere. It's not about fitting the picture to a like a glove. It's not about hitting every beat and taking every footstep and matching it with some kind of music. It's about creating a sense and a feeling from what the movie is. And I think that there are plenty of movies, if you listen to them without the score, you would have a completely different attitude toward the movie.
Yeah, there's a,
I think there have been times when music has actually elevated the movie.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot of theory about, you know, what would Psycho be, what would even like a good superhero movie be without, you know, some of the scores. And there's some funny YouTube videos or Instagram reels or TikToks or whatever, where they take a serious scene and they put funny music over it, and just to see like how it changes, or like they'll put like the Seinfeld bass slaps serious scene, just to see like how that, because it's very unconscious, I think. So sometimes I wonder, like a movie that people might consider mediocre, if you changed out the composer, well, how much of that would really make a difference? Like
I think it might make a lot of difference, because mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine, not that Star Wars was not a good movie all the way through, but can you imagine Star Wars without Williams' themes?
Yeah.
Without Darth Vader, without the heroic fanfares. I mean, come on. Or Raiders. or E.T., a completely different kind of movie, without Williams' emotional attachment.
Yeah, I just watched E.T. with my kids. It was their first time watching it, and just the music just like pulls your heartstrings.
Totally. And the difference is that it's not always manipulative. It's not telling you how to feel. It's supporting what the movie wants you to feel. And that's what a good composer learns how to do, in my estimation.
Mm-hmm. You talked about Max Steiner and John Williams. What other composers influenced you?
Well, Herman, for sure. Goldsmith. Korn Gold's another one that's great. If we're talking about the old classic guys. The classic guys invented the genre. We're all standing on their shoulders.
Right.
And it's true, because back in the day when movies were nascent, when they were just getting, nobody really knew. There was a period of time where everybody said, well, where's that music coming from? Why is there score? What is this? You know, there's no band on the screen. What does it mean? And Steiner and those guys had to fight against that. They talk about it a lot in the book. And they had to invent the language of movie scoring. And so I always, they're my go-to guys. I go back to them quite a bit. I think that Brian Tyler is a fantastic composer these days. Who else would I think of? Bear McCreary, I think, is fantastic. There are just a ton of really good creative composers now. I'm still tangentially involved with Dune, and so Klaus's score for the new Dunes, Zimmer. Hans Zimmer, yeah. His music for the new Dune is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
It creates a world in your mind.
Yeah, you said something that just struck a chord with me about developing the language of it, because it's sometimes watching older movies can be a little challenging because they haven't got it down. So like when you watch like the original Frankenstein versus Bride of Frankenstein, it's amazing because those movies came out like only like a year or so apart.
Yeah.
But like how much differently like they've got the language of film changed.
Yeah, how fast they learn what they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And what they could get away with, but how they could lead you into a story. I mean, it was really inventing a whole new language of drama and narration,
which is always evolving and changing. Like, you know, if you look at movies like a 10-year period, yeah, there's definitely changes in styles that are evolving, and off its taste or just artistry. But yeah,
well, in the early days, I think people looked at it as we're just going to film a play.
Exactly. Yeah.
They didn't understand what cinematic language would be or could be.
Mm-hmm.
But they learned pretty damn quick.
And what's interesting is that we've almost come to a point where some of that language I think would help in a way, or traditions, like, again, talking about Oppenheimer, it's a 3-hour movie and it could really benefit from an intermission. And it's very, you could definitely tell it's very act orientated. So it's definitely a 3-act thing. So I'm shocked almost that they didn't put in a 5-minute, because why wouldn't the theaters want people to go use the restroom and get more soda? And I know it's just not something American audience are probably used to, but it's
But we used to be.
Mm-hmm.
We used to be. And that was not an uncommon thing. One of my favorite movies, if not my favorite movie, Lawrence of Arabia, has one right in the middle. But so many movies back then, I think Kwai had one. I think all the big Cinerama movies, How the West Was Won, and all of those had intermissions.
Then if you go to lots of other countries, they'll have, every movie has their intermission, even if it's 90 minutes or 80 minutes.
Yeah.
Because they want to sell more popcorn, or, you know, give everyone a chance or want to stretch their legs. It's pretty funny.
I haven't thought about that. I really haven't thought about that. I know that people have gotten a lot of movie fatigue with 3 and 3.5 hour movies. And maybe this is a way to kind of solve it. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a discussion amongst my friends of like how long, who gets to earn a 3-hour movie? Like Scorsese earns a 3-hour movie, Nolan, Jordan Peele.
Yeah,
you have to be at a certain level to earn a 3-hour movie. But like, very few superhero movies should be 3 hours. Like an Endgame, okay, but I don't know. I don't know if a Batman movie needs to be 3 hours. I have a bit of a gripe with that. But
Nolan's movies, I never had a problem with in terms of their length.
Exactly.
And Scorsese's movies too. Somehow they have figured out a way to constantly keep your attention riveted. Who was it that used to say, I can tell a movie is too long when my butt starts to scratch in the seat.
You know? Right. Definitely. So going back to music, let's talk about a little more pop music though. What albums have influenced you the most?
Oh my God. Well, I have to admit that I'm really not up on very much contemporary music.
Well, not now, but like over your, within your lifespan.
Well, within my lifespan, I came up in the rock and roll era. So yeah. My major influences were the blues musicians, the blues and jazz musicians, the great, you know, the Muddy Waters, the Howlin' Wolfs, the Buddy Guys, that kind of very raw, emotional songwriting. Of course, I love the Beatles. I think they were geniuses. And the Stone stuff is always great. But I was always torn between that kind of pop music and, say, more clinical is not the right word, but more practice musicianship that jazz players had. Because of my background, not that I was ever as good as those guys, but people like Miles Davis and Mingus and that era of jazz players really drive me nuts. I love them. And today there are several bands. I think Tedeschi Trucks is an unbelievable band. Great musicianship. There's a band called Snarky Puppy, which is a jazz fusion band. I just went to see them with my son in DC. Just unbelievable musicianship. It's complicated music. I'd say probably one of the most contemporary artists that was a go-to person for me just because of his virtuosity was Jeff Beck. Heartbroken that he's not with us anymore. Because his stuff was always interesting and nobody played the guitar like him. I suppose if Hendrix had lived, who knows what he would have come up with, but Beck just, he was miles above everybody.
Right.
Shorthand, that's sort of, I mean, I can appreciate other stuff. I can appreciate rap and hip hop. I don't really know it that well, and I don't follow it. There's even some heavy metal that I, you know, can appreciate. There's this band called Rammstein.
Well, yeah.
You know Rammstein?
Oh yeah.
My son got me into that, and they are fantastic. I mean, because they're really good musicians. Their music happens to be like, you know, blow you back, but they're very cool. And I'm going to go see with my son, I'm going to go see this band called Ghost,
which is a
Scandinavian band. Really great.
Yeah, Ghost are great.
I like some of that stuff. I'm not a Taylor Swift fan that much, but I don't really know her stuff.
If you get a chance to see, I think they just finished a tour, but if you get to see Rammstein, they have, or at least go to YouTube at one of their concerts.
And really? Oh, okay.
Great. It's very visually interesting. There's like huge pyrotechnics and all kinds of. Like the keyboardist, he's on the treadmill. He's like tied to a treadmill and he's got a keyboard in front of him and he's playing while like, it's crazy. It's crazy. I love it.
Yeah. You say they just finished the tour?
I think so. I know they were in LA 6 months ago, something like that. Obviously go check their site and see.
I'd love to see them live sometime.
Yeah. They're a good time. Okay. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about or promote or any other projects?
No, I mean, listen, I am just very fortunate that I'm still working, that there are people in this business that are crazy or desperate enough to want to work with me. So,
fans that are crazy enough to want to listen to you.
Well, that's always great. And I don't think they're crazy.
Well, crazy in a good way, like nuts about
crazy in a good way.
Crazy about your work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all right. But, if people are interested in reading a good creepy novel, I've got a new one out, and, it's been a great thing for me to have another avenue, another venue for my storytelling, because that's what I really think of myself. I mean, I have directed, I love being on the floor. And I've composed, as you say, and I've written, but to me, they're all just storytelling. And that's what I love. And so any medium that allows me to do that, I'm there.
Well, as your good friend Clive Barker says, you are a born storyteller.
Well, right. He's being very kind.
There
From
you go.
One born storyteller to another, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Huh? All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Where can people follow you for updates?
There's my website, which is officialjohnharrison.com.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. Although I don't use Twitter or Facebook that much, but
whatever it is now,
X, yeah.
you have a great assistant helping you with your Instagram. Just want to shout out to whoever that is. They've been a great help.
Jessica Stell, yeah, she's great because I'm an older guy. I don't know how to do that shit.
So your Instagram is Official John Harrison.
Yes. And my website is officialjohnharrison.com. And so you can pretty much find everything about me there.
Okay. Well, that wraps things up. We thank everyone for listening to Dads from the Crypt.
Follow Dads from the Crypt on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or I will follow you to the grave. No, seriously, you really should watch, but be careful what you ask for. You may get it. Ha 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 ha